Well, hello and welcome back to part two of the Patreon dry dock. There's plenty more questions to go through, so, well, let's just get started with going through them. Brad in SoCal asks, blockades have been in the news again. During the period the channel covers, were there any successful blockades where the blockaded country employed patrol aircraft? Or were blockades a tactic that mostly worked before aircraft were available to interdict the blockading vessels? Yeah, well, World War One and World War Two exist. World War One, I mean, yeah, technically patrol aircraft were employed by Imperial Germany, as were Zeppelins. But to be perfectly fair, given the position of most of the Allied blockade, mostly the British blockade, obviously the sort of the Northern Barrage and stuff, aircraft weren't a huge factor at that point. Whereas, obviously, World War Two, aircraft were a huge factor because the British still put a blockade in on Germany, which ultimately, you know, Germany did run out of a lot of rather important equipment, or rather the materials to make very important equipment properly, and, you know, tungsten, stuff like that. But, of course, in World War II, Germany did have quite a lot of patrol aircraft, like the famous FW-200 Condor. Part of the reason that the Germans didn't have vast amounts of success interdicting the blockading vessels was, of course, the German aircraft had other duties, like trying to coordinate the U-boats to enact their own trade blockade on Britain. Another issue was that in order to find the blockading forces, because, of course, at this point in the 20th century, you're talking about a more distant blockade than the kind of close blockade you see in the Age of Sail, you have to go out a fair distance. And that means, if especially in World War II, when you're talking about, you know, not GPS navigation, you have to have fairly large multi-engine aircraft on patrol to find your targets in the first place. And those aircraft are fairly big, fairly expensive, and fairly vulnerable if the blockading forces either have their own air support or just have a half-decent aim with anti-aircraft guns, because, yeah, hitting a fast-moving, manoeuvring single-engine fighter or strike aircraft is one thing. Hitting a 2-, 3-, 4-engine patrol aircraft that wanders a bit too close, that's quite another. Now, of course, the German pilots weren't dumb. They did learn to circle beyond anti-aircraft range and report things in. But even when you have found a blockading force and you've reported it in, then you also have to have a fairly large contingent of long-range bombers. And those bombers will have to have roughly similar performance to your patrol aircraft, because although they don't have to loiter for ages searching, because that's what the patrol aircraft is doing, they do have to carry a meaningful amount of weaponry, and they have to carry it a fair distance out. And of course, once they get there, they'll be subject to even more intensive defensive measures, because, well, one, the targets will know something's coming, and two, at least up until the invention of standoff weaponry, the bombers have to get a lot closer to the target, because they've got to, you know, drop weapons on them, as opposed to the patrol aircraft, which can comfortably sit outside even the range of the heaviest anti-aircraft guns, because all it's got to do is see them. And that's assuming that, you know, the targets haven't moved off somewhere, either distance-wise or gone under weather cover or something like that. And so while any one individual patrol or strike aircraft will cost considerably less than any one individual blockading ship, the sheer number of aircraft and aircrew and infrastructure to support them that you need to attack any individual blockading ship, multiplied by the number of airbases you need to stock in that manner to, you know, patrol the entire length of the area where you're being blockaded, means that even with the existence of aircraft, blockades will still massively sap your resources. And there's no real guarantee that it's actually going to work, because, yeah, you might blow up one or two small blockading ships, and then the enemy can just show up with more blockading ships, as in a group, to enhance their defensive capability. And then, of course, you get escort carriers, long-range fighters, bomber and fighter-bomber attacks on the airfields of the patrol aircraft, and so on and so forth. Ian Carr asks, were faults understood and changes made to the later King George V's in light of the sinking of Prince of Wales? And similarly, was consideration given to changing B turret back to a quad 14-inch after the treaty expired? How much change and disruption would the latter have caused? By the time it became clear that the Second London Naval Treaty was dead in the water, there was some discussion back and forth about alternate armament arrangements for the King George V, whether they should have the originally planned 12, 14-inch guns, whether they should shift up to 15 or even 16-inch weapons, aka kind of short-circuit the Lion development, and so forth. But none of these conversations were, I would say, particularly serious. They were more kind of theory crafting, okay, what kind of, why aren't we doing this, rather than, oh, I think we should do this, what are the details? And that was mainly because of that two-gun turret being there. I think if they'd kept with the four quads, or the three quads, sorry, four guns per turret, going all the way through from the original build, then seeing them switch out for 16s, kind of like the North Carolinas did, might have had a bit more of a serious discussion going on, except for the, you know, the problems with building the 16-inch guns that they had for the Lions. So that probably would have killed it anyway, but it might have gotten considerably further. The problem is there's no easy way to make a twin 14-inch turret into a twin 16-inch, or heaven forbid a triple 16-inch, without, you know, things get becoming really, really complicated and difficult. And when it comes to going back to the quad 14, again, because of that twin, you'd have to completely redesign the bow. The barbette's obviously got to be considerably larger. You've got to install double the magazine capacity for B turret. You've got to put in double the number of hoists. You've got to therefore either massively cut back on the superstructure, or you've got to shift a turret forward. All of that, plus the additional weight of going from a twin to a quad, is going to unbalance the ship, so you've got to completely rebalance the ship. So essentially, there's no way to take the final design drawings that have been issued for the King George V and go, okay, actually, guys, we're switching back to the quad 14. You'd have to have wound it all the way back to whatever state the drawings were in for the three quad version and advance those through the final detailed design process. And an awful lot of stuff that had been manufactured at that point would have had to been scrapped, including the twin 14-inch turrets themselves, because, of course, these are very long lead items. Now, as far as changes to Duke of York Anson and how, as a result of Prince of Wales's sinking, well, obviously, once the sinking took place, they had to do the whole inquiry and work out what exactly had gone on, which meant getting the survivors back to the UK, etc. And Duke of York is near enough done at that point, and Anson and Howe are not that far behind. So there's not really the scope to make major changes underwater, like changing the torpedo defense system and things like that. And indeed, they are already making changes to Duke of York, Anson and Howe, but most of those changes are to do with increasing levels of anti-aircraft protection and things like this. There were a few changes that were made both to, well, the later King George V and King George V herself and some other British warships, mostly capital ships, as a result of the findings from the sinking of Prince of Wales, but it was mostly in terms of increasing redundancy of damage control, more generators and pumps, etc., that wouldn't be knocked offline by the main boilers going down and things like this. Because, as I said, even the least advanced of the King George V was far too complete at the stage that Prince of Wales sank, let alone by the time they'd done their inquiries, to make major structural changes to the ship. And ultimately, don't start up a propeller shaft that potentially has been bent by a torpedo impact is not something that you can change by making changes to the design. Arctiniz, I think, asks, it is sometimes claimed that the sound of the bombardment before the Battle of the Somme could be heard as far away as London. My question is, how far would the sound of naval battles carry in the period the channel covers? How far away could someone have heard the Battle of Trafalgar, for instance? How about the Battle of Jutland, with its multiplicity of large-caliber artillery? Well, the one I've usually heard for World War I land campaigns is those massive mines that they dug under the German trenches and set off, and those supposedly were heard in the UK when they were blown up. But when it comes to naval battles, I think it's a mixture of geography and atmosphere. Because if you're having a battle, let's say, in a bay, then no matter how loud that battle gets, if the bay it has lots of high-sided cliffs that are basically going to, you know, contain, deflect, and reflect most of the sound back out to sea, then if the coast is high, because obviously cliffs, and then maybe it slopes down, someone 10, 15 miles away will probably never know much of anything if there's any degree of ambient noise where they are. Conversely, if you have a battle far out to sea and there's no intervening geography and the atmospheric conditions are right, then the kind of rumble of battle, especially if you're talking a major battle like Trafalgar or Jutland, where you've got lots of guns going off near constantly, that can carry a fairly long way. But the thing is, you can have the same battle with exactly the same guns, exactly the same explosions, being fought in exactly the same place on two different days, and how far that sound travels will vary hugely. You know, if you've got really rough seas, or if the atmosphere is of such a condition that the sound basically can just travel straight up into the atmosphere without much in the way of reflection, then that sound really isn't going to carry very far at all. Whereas if you've got a relatively calm sea and you have quite distinct layers of density and perhaps also moisture at varying levels in the atmosphere, and particularly if some of those are relatively close to the ground, then you can essentially end up with an audio tunnel where the sound waves are in part bouncing off of the atmosphere and back down, and bouncing off of the sea and back up. And at that point, that battle could be heard dozens and dozens of miles away. It's not exactly the same, but you see very similar principles when it comes to propagation of sound underwater with thermocline layers and, of course, the state of the sea surface. And also when it comes to certain kinds of radio frequency transmission and the potential to bounce some of those off of various parts of the Earth's atmosphere. As I say, it's not exactly the same, but the general principle of certain atmospheric, or in the case of sonar, oceanic conditions, allowing for this kind of tunneling effect, thus allowing for the propagation of noise considerably further, also applies to generic sound in the general atmosphere. And that does, of course, also mean that a battle, depending on exactly what the atmospheric conditions are like, could be heard for dozens of miles in one direction and only a dozen or so in the other. 1903 Spring Roll asks, "The Knight's Cross with gold, oak leaves, swords and diamonds was supposed to be awarded to the 12 most distinguished servicemen of the Reich. Assuming that the Kriegsmarine got 3 awards, what would, or who would you give them to?" Well, I think I'm going to have to go with who do I think the Kriegsmarine would have given them to, because if it was up to me, I would probably, give them to people like Canaris for actively sabotaging the Nazi war effort. But if we're going via the Kriegsmarine rules, I think you probably would give one to whoever the surviving highest scoring U-boat captain would have been at the time, bearing in mind that, as far as I'm aware, I think they were supposed to be kind of post-war awards, kind of compilation of achievement awards rather than stuff that you get during the war. But my precise knowledge on German military decorations of World War II is not that high. But assuming that that's the case, then yeah, give one to the highest scoring U-boat captain who's still alive. I think you could probably find at least one German Schnellboot crew captain who deserves one, because the E-boats or S-boats really put in a good shift for the Kriegsmarine during the war. And probably whoever's the longest serving captain of Prince Eugen, because I've called her a luck vampire before. She gave really good service to the Kriegsmarine and somehow managed not to die despite virtually every other German ship she came in contact with, you know, dying spectacularly and horribly in various ways. And it's not like the Hipper class as a whole covered itself in luck or glory. But Prince Eugen's kind of the exception to almost all the rules. If the gods had meant us to be happy, they would have invented an alcoholic honey-based beverage. Oh, look, Mead asks, if the Royal Navy had kept the demilitarized Iron Dukes around following the First London Naval Treaty as accommodation or other similar ships, and then following the Munich Agreement had remilitarized them, how useful would they have been in the following roles? Firstly, as convoy escort ships with A, B, X, and Y turrets reinstalled using 14-inch guns, but Q turret removed for aircraft handling facilities and perhaps some more engine space, or B, converted into supersized escort carriers for carrying anti-submarine planes into the mid-Atlantic to close that gap. Well, I mean, either option is going to need a massive amount of work to be done, but I think the weird thing is that, assuming you're going to go through with the massive cost and expense in finding the shipyard space as well to pull this off, the two types that you propose would be more useful at different points in the war, because a rearmed convoy escort ship, so basically an 8-14-inch gun modernized vessel, so presumably maybe they give like it a Warspite level of modernization, that would be quite useful in the early part of the war, because of course the speed might go up a little bit if you get completely getting rid of Q turret and you're replacing the machinery with brand new modern stuff. The flip side is obviously speed, while it might go up because of that, it might kind of then come down because you are going to need to put some anti-torpedo defenses on there, so bulging and so forth. But any case, in the very early part of the war, where you've got Hilfskreuzer and Panzerschiff and the Scharnhorst floating around, then they would be very useful as deterrents to all of those, which also then frees up other more frontline battleships to take the fight to the enemy. But once that initial threat of German surface raiders has gone away after the first couple of years or so, there's still the threat of things like Tirpitz and Scharnhorst, but it's a much more contained threat at that point. Once the main threat of German surface raiders, I should say, has gone away, they don't really have a huge amount of use in that context, and outside of maybe becoming dedicated shore bombardment ships, that they very quickly run out of things to do. Because being slow, you're not going to send them on Arctic convoy escort duty. For the same reason, they can't really go to the Pacific. You could maybe make Cunningham somewhat happy by rocking up with them and just giving him a bulk of battleships, which, I mean, yeah, in that refit configuration, they can still go toe-to-toe with the Italian 12.6-inch refits. And if they'd been fully refitted, they might be a little bit faster than some of the Rs that he was given at various points. But they really would drop off in utility rather dramatically. Whereas if you instead turn them into carriers, which might be somewhat easier if they've been, you know, largely demilitarized at that point with turrets taken off and everything, then essentially you're building four slightly smaller versions of HMS Eagle. And if you really go to ham with the extreme overhangs that you get on HMS Ark Royal, you could even get essentially, roughly speaking, an Eagle type carrier, although obviously with updated designs and facilities. And those initially in the early part of the war would not be as of great utility compared to the gun-armed variant because, well, German surface raiders and so forth, they're not as good against that. They'll have small air groups. The fleet air arm is quite small. They probably can't afford to stock them and all the other carriers that they're developing. But once that initial threat of surface raiders is over and now the fleet air arm has a bunch of extra large-ish carriers, they're not full-size, but they've still got okay-ish air groups for the North Atlantic and so forth. As essentially, you might as well consider them eagle adjacent. Then, while they're not the fastest, they're not got the largest air groups, they exist and then would start to become more and more useful. I mean, they're not going to have armored flight decks, which makes putting them in the Mediterranean somewhat dicey, although Eagle obviously did not actually end up succumbing to air attack. So again, perhaps using them to strengthen the Mediterranean would be quite welcome, but using them specifically as giant escort carriers, I think initially you would see them used in kind of a frontline combat roles, even if not. But then as the fleet air arm, obviously having the flight decks has reason to expand and the need for carriers in the Atlantic becomes greater and greater, and more of the more recent armored carriers are coming online, then you may very well see them being deployed as kind of the core of proto hunter killer groups. So something like first or second escort group may then be centered on one of these things, which can then sit out in the middle of the Atlantic, essentially as, well, a mobile floating airfield, closing off that bit to U-boats. Now, of course, there is the risk of everything going all courageous on you, but hopefully at that point you've got more anti-submarine escorts to go around, and also by operating in the mid-Atlantic you're making it a lot harder for the U-boats to find you, and of course by that point you'd also have Bletchley Park, who, you know, if the U-boat's going, hang on, we've seen a big British carrier, we should go after it, that's probably a legitimate time to phone them up and go, yeah, you probably want to move a couple of hundred miles away from that location quite quickly. And while, again, their slower speed would make them less useful, I mean, escort carriers weren't exactly fast themselves either, so they would have more and more utility as time went on. Arctic convoy escorts, potentially, and then heading into the Pacific, again, not necessarily as front line for the British Pacific Fleet, but perhaps also supplementing the escort carriers in shuttling aircraft back and forth to the British Pacific Fleet. Hark asks, hello, if a Navy seeks to engage in heavy commerce raiding using submarines, then under which circumstances would it be beneficial to build submarine classes dedicated to such operations? For example, the Regia Marina had submarines like this with the Cagney class, using smaller diameter torpedoes sufficient against merchants, which allowed them to have plenty of tubes and carry lots of reloads. I wonder about the various factors that could come into effect here. I could see a smaller navy deciding against such specialist submarines, as having a submarine force that is as flexible as possible would be preferable if you won't have too many of them. But I could also see a larger navy declining to build such submarines, as building general purpose submarines could be cheaper than building various classes in parallel. And simply producing a lot of one type could compensate for any individual shortcomings. So when might a navy decide to go for submarines as specialised as the Cagney class? Well, I think it's going to depend quite a lot on the geographical circumstances that your navy finds itself in. Because when you look at most of the World War II period navies, British, German, French, Japanese, and Italian, because they have potential enemies both nearby and potential operational areas far away, you see quite a range of submarine classes being built anyway. You know, small coastal submarines for coastal defense and nearby coastal attack, medium range submarines, which usually tend to be the workhorses of the fleet, and some longer range submarines for extended operations. And that's before you get to stuff like mine layers and so forth. And hyper specialized stuff like midget subs, X-craft and such like. It's only really when you get to someone like the Americans, who only really have potential enemies of any substantial size in naval terms really far away, that you see a kind of trend towards standardizing around a single type of sub, in their case the fleet sub, although even then they do still do periodic experiments with smaller short-range subs. Now, notice I didn't include many of the smaller navies, because like you said, smaller navies, generally speaking, are either very close in defensively and or they can only afford one or two classes of subs anyway, so they're not going to be hyper-specializing. But I think to have a very specialist type like the Cagney class, you have to, at least to my mind, make a certain series of assumptions in your planning. Firstly, that your opponent is going to have a large number of merchant ships which need to be attacked. Now, obviously, not all circumstances will actually have that. Secondly, those ships are not going to be particularly well escorted, or you don't think the efficacy of anti-submarine warfare by escorting ships is particularly high. And the reason I say that is because if you are going to do something like the Cagney class, you really want to go big or go home. So they're going to be fairly substantial subs, and that in turn means they're probably going to be relatively slow diving. They're not going to be the world's most agile subs, and they're going to be easy to spot from the air, because that is the trade-off. Because if you're taking, let's say in this case, 18-inch instead of 21-inch torpedoes, yes, on a normal sub, that might eke out 3-4 more torpedoes. But of course, thanks to the square cube law making its wonderful return to the channel, if you make your sub somewhat larger, you've massively increased internal volume. And if you are simultaneously using significantly smaller volume torpedoes, suddenly you can stack a huge number of torpedoes, relatively speaking, into your sub. Plus, of course, a bigger sub, again with more internal volume, means more fuel, longer range, very important for hunting merchant ships, greater endurance on station, and, at least as far as you can make a submarine, far more comfortable accommodations for the crew, which is also very important for long-distance, long-term operations. Now, the only other variant to that would be if you are either in control or near a particular choke point, which you can contest, basically ensuring the enemy doesn't have control of it, where you know the enemy has to pass through. Because if that is the case, then you don't necessarily have to go extremely long distances to find your targets. You can just get away with, you know, a relatively nearby area because you know the enemy supplies must come past that region. But even then, I think you'd still want the larger submarine, partly for munitions load reasons, but also because even if you're not going all that far, having a huge amount of endurance means you can get into position, you can settle in, you can choose the most optimal strike angles, and you can wait. So you could, in theory, you know, if you think, well, there's an enemy convoy coming through at some point in the next week, you could go out at the beginning of the week and just wait for them to come. And there's not a huge amount they can do about that other than actively sanitizing the area, which is why I said you have to be able to at least contest the area. Now, of the big five navies of World War II that have a reasonable duration in the actual conflict, I don't think this kind of sub really suits the British, because the vast majority of the people they're likely to be at war with, and indeed end up at war with, don't have a particularly large merchant marine. And the one lot of people who do, Japan, if Britain ends up at war with Japan, they're going to need subs that can down warships as well, because that's how Japan's going to exert its power. The Italians, with the best will in the world, I don't think needed the Cagney class. They were a good idea in principle, but honestly, the Mediterranean is far too confined waters for that, especially when you're going up against the British, who are quite good at anti-submarine warfare. And yeah, you can send them out to the Atlantic, but as the Regia Mariner found out, there's a whole load of operational hazards involved with just getting there in the first place. So there's some utility if you're going for the Atlantic, but really most of the Regia Mariner's focus is on the Mediterranean, so not really worth it. The Germans might seem like they have the best utility for this kind of thing. Unfortunately, however, again, they're going up against the British, who are very good at anti-submarine warfare, at which point you do want a somewhat swifter, smaller, more agile sub, because the escort's going to be very angry with you. And that leaves the Japanese and the Americans. And I think these two are probably the two navies that could make use of such a submarine the most. The Japanese slightly less so, but the Japanese were in the habit of building very large, very long-range submarines. So I think they could plausibly have built a very large, very long-range commerce raiding sub if their mentality at the time had allowed for it, in the view of sending them over to somewhere like the West Coast and just camping the West Coast. Because at that point, yeah, warships will be sent after them, but the West Coast is so large, and, well, the Eastern Pacific is so large, they can just go elsewhere. The Americans, however, are probably actually the one nation who could have benefited from this kind of submarine the most because, well, they're going over an extremely long distance. They're going up against a nation that has a reasonably sized merchant marine and needs that merchant marine for its very survival. And for the most part, isn't particularly brilliant at anti-submarine warfare. So at that point, yeah, a giant US submarine stocked with ridiculous numbers of 18-inch torpedoes doodling around, lobbing massive, you know, 8, 10, 12 torpedo spreads at the Japanese merchant marine, that could have been really handy. John McCarthy asks, what are the most important sources of error when aiming big guns, and how do they differ between optical and radar-based fire control systems? Well, there are all sorts of errors that can creep in to aiming big guns, but the biggest ones, for the most part, either the ones that are probably going to crop up the most often, are going to be, for optical systems, operator fatigue, which is more pronounced as stereoscopic than coincidence rangefinders, but can affect both. So essentially human error. You know, if the human's eyes, brain, whatever, if they misalign those prisms or whatever other optical system they're using and they end up reading out the wrong figure because they're convinced that that's where the images coincided or overlaid each other, then obviously now the range is off. And similarly, when you're estimating bearing and speed, in fact, I would say probably speed estimation is the single largest source of error when it comes to human computation, because you can train and pick specialist rangefinder operators who are less likely to make a ranging error. But working out what exactly is the enemy ship's bearing and speed, that is a very subjective thing. And that's why you will very often end up with initial salvos either, you know, going too far ahead or too far behind. And then as they correct, you end up with longs and shorts, which is basically they're on target as far as the rate of advance of the ship is. It's just they've estimated the range slightly off. The other big source is going to be calibration, because these are very delicate instruments doing basic but very fine scale calculations. And, well, they're in a fairly hostile environment, so small errors can creep in over time, which is one of the reasons why a lot of nations would introduce multiple optical rangefinders and then do something like average out between them, or use readings from multiple rangefinders to identify which ones were giving wild readings and might be a bit out of alignment. Now, with radar-based fire control systems, there is still a human element involved, and it very much also depends on what kind of display and what kind of resolution you have on your radar. So if you're using the old oscilloscope style and there's just a spike, you then have a human operator who's got to try and determine, okay, whereabouts exactly is this spike peaking? And is that actually where the target is? Or is it slightly to the left or slightly to the right of that? And bear in mind, it's usually not a steady spike. It's usually, you know, varying up and down and oscillating slightly. With a PPI scope, it's slightly easier because, of course, you can put graduated scale and potentially even zoom on a PPI scope, which makes measuring a little bit easier. But there is still human interpolation involved. And, of course, there are still calibration errors involved there, because while you're getting, essentially with radar, a lot of readings one after the other, so in theory, you shouldn't get random wild results the way you might do with a optical rangefinder. The fact is that how those results are being displayed, how the calculations are being made to display that, that's, again, all subject to calibration. If someone hasn't calibrated it properly, even if they're off by just a tiny fraction, then all the results are going to be off by a tiny fraction, and then you're not going to shoot straight. Then, of course, you have the actual fire control system itself, making sure that's all in sync and the gears are working and nothing's fallen out or no teeth have stripped. And then when you're actually firing the guns themselves, you've got to hope that either the turret crew, or if you're using RPC, the motors and so forth, are actually pointing in the way that you want them to. And then you have to hope you fire at just the right opportunity, because remember, those guns might be stabilized in the vertical, but a ship that's moving at speed is moving in all three dimensions. David Pierce asks, regarding Warspite's actions in Narvik, was there ever any analysis, photographs, etc., of the 15-inch gun's effect on German destroyers? I've watched your videos on it, obviously, and there was a big boom and the small ship was sunk, but I'm curious about the types of shells used and their physical effects. There are some basic observations in Warspite's log and report from the Battle of, well, the technically what I would call the Third Battle of Narvik, and those are quite interesting. Obviously, they record what kinds of shells they were using at any given time, but honestly, a lot of it is obviously kind of, yeah, we shot at a destroyer with a 15-inch guns. It didn't end well for the destroyer because, well, that's what you'd expect, and that's also what they were able to observe. Although I must admit, going back through the ridiculous numbers of pages I've got scanned from the various reports from both of the battles in Narvik involving the Royal Navy, going back through the communications logs is hilarious. Once you understand the kind of people who were involved, you can read between the lines an awful lot. There's obviously a lot of very short, not terse, but short and concise information being exchanged between all the various ships. And the, you know, when you read certain sentences and you put them in the context of what's been said before and after, you really get a sense of some of the incredibly snarky hidden messages in that. I mean, it's not particularly snarky, but when Punjabi has to drop back, she's like, look, I'm really sorry, but the guns aren't working, the main steam pipe's cut, I can't really do much. But then there's kind of a report, I think it's for Herjansfjord, where one of the destroyers is like, I suspect some of the enemy has retreated into Herjansfjord. And then about half a page later, there's a message from Warspite like, there's nothing in Herjansfjord except for a burning destroyer. And the subject is like, and I'm the one who set it on fire. So, yeah, it goes on like that. Anyway, getting back to the actual point, the problem is that, of course, the Royal Navy left Narvik after that battle. So they didn't get a chance to look over all of the various wrecks in detail and conduct forensic examinations of them. And by the time they were in a position to do that, well, it was 1945 and they had better things to be getting on with. So I suspect any detailed examination of what happened to them and the effects of the individual shells was probably done by the Germans themselves in the aftermath of the Norway campaign, and therefore they'd be in the German archives somewhere. Gabriel A. Hawkins asks, one of the many things in naval history that I don't understand, as in why isn't it talked about more, is Admiral Richardson's opposition to moving the fleet to Pearl Harbor. I have yet to hear a single coveted Muppet designation on this channel or anywhere else for what seems to be the biggest example of a politician disagreeing with the military and giving rise to a predictable result. Why do you think Admiral Richardson's firing has not received more attention? I think there are quite a few different reasons why Richardson's firing hasn't got more attention. In a very broad sense, obviously the US won the Pacific War in the end, so it's sometimes inconvenient to point out that, at least for political history purposes, that it really wasn't a good idea to move to Pearl Harbor. Also, it somewhat undermines the image of the US Navy in particular, because, when you look at it from a situation of the whole war, obviously, you know, there's the whole, you know, Pearl Harbor got hit, it got rebuilt, the massive industrial machine of the US churned out a war-winning fleet and all of this. But when you look through the various bits of correspondence that are being exchanged between Richardson and Stark, Admiral Stark, and various other senior officials and officers, the picture that's painted in 1940 and early 1941 of Pearl Harbor and the decision to stay there is one that really is not at all flattering. Richardson enumerates numerous things they don't have. They don't have enough paint to keep the ships from rusting away. There aren't enough keel blocks in the Pearl Harbor dry docks to allow them to actually keep up with the maintenance schedule for the ships. There's not enough ammunition to keep the ships supplied even for basic training, especially 5-inch 38 ammunition. There's not enough fuel, and there's not enough fuel being supplied. He points out, I believe that it's that they're going to be using about 200,000 barrels of oil a month, and they're only getting 100,000 barrels of oil at that point, fresh. So they're going to run down the stocks pretty quickly. He also points out, you know, the US fleet total only has 2 ammunition ships. So even if you start addressing the ammunition problems right now, it's going to take quite a while before we have anything like an acceptable level of ammunition. He also points out that it's not entirely clear, are we here as a deterrent force, but mostly hoping that the deterrent bit will win, and therefore we maintain a peacetime tempo of operations for training and so forth, or are we here expecting war, in which case we have to undertake a completely different kind of set of operations, and if you don't make it clear which one or the other we're supposed to do, then we're going to end up not accomplishing either thing and end up with a poorly trained force that ends up having to go to war. And no one can give him a clear answer. And there's the whole thing of, you know, the movement wasn't planned particularly. It was, there's the fleet problem. The fleet is at Hawaii at the end of the fleet problem, and then he's basically told, actually, we're keeping the fleet at Hawaii. And he's like, well, loads of stuff that we need is still on the West Coast because you didn't tell us that we were supposed to be here. And for months afterwards, it's all characterized as a delay, rather than a delay in going back to the West Coast, rather than a permanent repositioning. And because various things are out of Richardson's direct control, including things like the supply of ammunition, he can sit there going, look, we need this. But then other departments which don't directly answer to him are going, yeah, but you're not supposed to be there for that long. So we're going to keep this stuff back on the West Coast. And there's not a lot he can do about it. So the overall picture, and this isn't from, you know, oh, I think this, you think that. This is the official correspondence back and forth between Richardson and his superiors. It paints a picture of essentially a move which has put the US Navy in a completely unprepared position, and one that has actually compromised the fighting capabilities of what's about to become the Pacific Fleet. And it's been done mostly for political purposes. And in fact, later on, after he's relieved of command of the what is at that point is the Pacific Fleet, Richardson flat out says, you know, you're doing this for party political purposes, not for the good of the country. And he's even told flat out, hey, look, it, by this point, it's an election year. There are things we can do and things we can't do during an election year, and this is one of the things we can't do. And so, obviously, you have this kind of the mythos of Pearl Harbor, of, you know, the US fleet moves forward decisively to confront the Japanese, and the Japanese conduct a sneak attack, and obviously the tragedy of Pearl Harbor itself is on December 7th. And if you bring a lot more attention to Admiral Richardson's firing and, you know, how strident he was about it and what conditions actually were, you know, pointing out that the US fleet was moved there ad hoc, mostly for party political reasons, against the advice of the senior military officers, to a position that wasn't prepared, with a fleet that wasn't prepared, and no real way to solve the logistics problems quickly or easily, suddenly it kind of looks more and more, obviously, I'm not saying this is the case, but it can look more and more like, you know, in some ways the US got lucky at Pearl Harbor, i.e. if the Japanese had hit them sooner, it could have been even worse, considering that in the intervening period between the fleet being stationed there and Pearl Harbor, Admiral King and others were frantically going around installing every anti-aircraft gun they could possibly find on the fleet. So certainly from an external perspective, the more I look at the correspondence, the more and more I get the feeling it's not talked about, because ultimately it boils down to a lot of people don't want to admit that the main reason the US fleet was at Pearl Harbor was officially to deter the Japanese, but it was much, much more about getting certain people re-elected and looking strong than actually being strong, i.e. one of the things I hate, which is politicians trying to make the military do something but not actually paying for them to have the capability to do the thing they're asking for. André de Coult says, much has been said about British World War I shell failures and the Italian World War II varying accuracy. Could you tell us how and why World War II German shells had so many duds, and why did the Japanese Sanchiki Type 3 shell cause so much more barrel wear than armor-piercing and high-explosive shells? Well, several theories have been advanced for the Sanchiki Type 3 shells apparently causing more barrel wear than AP or HE shells. And initially that might seem surprising because they weigh the same as HE shells. So it's nothing to do with increased drag or being expelled too quickly at too high velocity, because in theory they should come out at exactly the same velocity as a regular HE shell. So the most commonly advanced theories that I've seen have either been that for whatever reason the driving bands on the Type 3 shells were not particularly well manufactured, and that could cause additional wear. And of course, you've got to remember that the Type 3 shell was in use on multiple different Japanese ships, not just the Yamatos. So given that, for example, you have the bombardment of Henderson Field, which uses a bunch of Type 3 shells, and they don't seem to have had too many problems with that, it could, if that was the case, it could be that there was some kind of production issue specifically with the driving bands for the Type 3 shell for the 18.1-inch guns. But I haven't seen anything definitive that actually says that was the case, but just a lot of, you know, people saying that that was the case in post-war interviews and accounts and things like that. Another theory is that because obviously there's a lot more complexity to the Type 3 shell than to an HE or an AP shell, that with the force of the explosion that accelerates it to high speed, and the fact obviously starting to spin up, the slight shifting of any one of many components, which ultimately are designed to fly apart when it actually is exploding, would then put the shell off balance and could cause the shell to basically rattle and bounce around inside the barrel before it leaves, which would, of course, cause more stress, which would cause more barrel wear. And another theory is that the shells were actually fine in both of those other regards, but simply the fact that in an anti-aircraft environment, you are firing the shells as fast as you humanly can, rather than with a battleship engagement where you take a fair bit of time to aim, correct, watch the fall of shot, etc. And therefore, simply with the sheer amount of propellant that's going into firing these things, if you're conducting long-term firing, you know, multiple salvos, as reloading as fast as possible, firing as fast as possible, you're going to end up causing a significant heat buildup in the barrel, which in turn may then cause erosion issues because, A, obviously everything inside is going to expand slightly, so the next shell is going to be a tighter fit, so it's going to drag slightly more. Plus, of course, hotter metal is weaker, and so on and so forth. So any and all of those have been advanced. In the absence of anything definitive that I can put my finger on and go, look, here is proof that the shell was poorly manufactured in some way, shape, or form, I'd tend to, if I was going to go with any of them, probably go with the idea that rapid firing 18.1-inch guns as fast as humanly possible for prolonged periods probably wasn't very good for their barrel life at all. With regards to the Germans having a fair number of either duds or what you call low-order explosions, partial detonations, basically not full-effect detonations, with their AP and semi-armor piercing shells, the most commonly advanced theory for that is a two-part thing, and this is actually backed up by evidence because you can look at the design papers and diagrams and so forth and actually see it in practice compared to others. And that is, firstly, that the Germans didn't seem to consider diving shells as either danger or potential weapon as much as other nations did. And as a result, they don't seem to have made much, if any, allocation in their shell design for something happening while the shell was traveling underwater, i.e. keeping it stable. The Japanese obviously went the most in that direction. And as a result, the German shell, which is optimized for travel purely through the air, upon hitting the water, will tumble quite violently, which can basically cause the fuse to fail, because the fuse is one of those weird things in that it's incredibly robust because it has to withstand the shock of the shell smashing into something at very high speed and then initiate itself. But it's also a very, very, very small, very fine mechanism. And yeah, when that gets swung around and round and round and round at, you know, under a lot of centrifugal force, when it's not really designed to stand up to that, it's designed to stand up to a direct force traveling up the shell, things break. You know, the little flame that goes between the initial fuse and the final payload detonating goes out, things get jammed and bent and so on and so forth. So that's one element to it. And the other element to it is the nature of the fuse design itself. So the shell obviously is mostly steel, but contains an explosive filler. And that main explosive charge is actually really, really, really insensitive. Like, you could walk up to a shell of anyone's navy, actually, but obviously in this case a German one, with a sledgehammer and smack it as hard as you possibly want. It's not going to detonate. That explosive is incredibly insensitive, which is why it needs a detonator of a somewhat more sensitive material to be initiated by the fuse to actually explode. However, obviously, that detonator and fuse is a much more sensitive explosive. That could potentially be set off by nearby shocks and stuff. And what appears to have happened is that in an effort to limit the amount of really sensitive explosives present aboard their ships, which is understandable in principle, the little picric acid or picric acid crystals that were to take the flame from the initial fuse going off and transmit that as an explosion strong enough to set off the main warhead, they seem to have minimized those compared to other nations, which in turn would mean that very minor changes in the pathway to the warhead, like, you know, the kind of very small changes that might be induced by the shockwave of a shell weighing as much as a small car slamming into several thousand tons of steel, on a slightly more regular fuse, that explosive pathway will still be forced open through and the shell detonates with a normal payload, but with a slightly smaller amount of picric acid crystals in there, or picric acid, whatever you want to call it, it either might not, or you might end up with a partial shockwave going through. So enough to initiate some of the explosive, but not all, and thus you get your low-order detonations. Or it fails completely and you get duds. Salamin Shakir 93 asks, what happens if the battlecruiser Courageous changed her screws to those of the minelayer Abdiels and vice versa, and both run at full power, given that their screws are the same diameter? Also, what happens if Hood and Abdiel swap their screw types and run at full power, since the latter with two screws has half the rated shaft horsepower of the former, with four, albeit larger, screws? Assuming modifications were made so Abdiel could fit Hood's screws, even with her shallow draft, of course. Well, without seeing the diagrams and plans for the various ship screws, I can only go off of general principles here. And that is, well, the Abdiels are designed for almost 40 knots, and therefore their screws, in terms of the blade area and the blade pitch, would have been designed to move enough water optimally to allow them to get that kind of speed. And also, of course, their fairly large screws for a ship of this size, and they're moving, therefore, a relatively speaking lighter weight. And obviously the screws on the Courageous, they're designed to move a heavier ship at a slower speed, so they're going to be optimized for that. And the screws on Hood are, as you said, larger and designed to move an even heavier ship slower still. So basically you're going to end up with non-optimal situations on all of them. So if Abd Steele was running on Courageous's screws, I would expect her to be slower because the screws aren't designed to shift quite as much water at those kinds of speeds. With Hood's screws, assuming, as you said, to make some kind of allowance for the fact these things are very large, you'd probably have significant issues with machinery because, of course, a bigger screw is going to be a heavier screw and the machinery setup is not necessarily designed to take that. Well, can the thrust blocks take it, etc.? You'll get up to speed eventually, but there will be a lot more resistance and so forth than you would have with the regular size screws. Potentially, just because they can shift more water, she might accelerate a bit quicker. She might be faster, depending on the design of exactly how Hood screws are pitched. But it's going to not do good things to the machinery at all. On the flip side, Courageous with Abdiel screws, I'd assume you might beget her moving a little bit quicker, but overall she's going to be much less efficient. And Hood with Abdiel screws, that's not going to end well, because then you've got the inverse. You've got a lightly loaded propeller shaft with non-optimal screws, so they're just going to go whizzing around. There's going to be a huge amount of cavitation, so there'll be an awful lot of water thrown about, and nothing good would come of that, I think. Something would break very quickly. Assuming, of course, as I said, that the screws are actually optimized for the design speeds of the ships. Tradesman's Entrance asks, we know how the Littorio class performed in the Mediterranean, but how do you think they'd have fared in the more extreme weather conditions found in the North Atlantic or the Pacific? I think in either of those environments, their single biggest problem actually would have been range, because of course they're designed to operate in the Mediterranean. They don't have a particularly long range for modern battleships in World War II. And so having to pop over to refuel or bring a tanker up to refuel them on a much more regular basis would probably be the single most irritating thing about operating them. Of course, there are ways to increase your fuel stowage, but they come at the expense of other things. But in terms of their other characteristics as ships, the two biggest issues they would have faced is, one, they tended to be quite wet, in naval terminology, i.e. they buried their bows in the sea at the slightest possible opportunity. And this is essentially because their bow design, in the interest of speed, was very slim and relatively lightweight. And so for the Mediterranean, it was passable, because even in the normally calm waters of the Mediterranean, they had a tendency of being quite wet up forward. But in terms of the broader scope, especially in somewhere like the Atlantic, where the seas are quite often quite rough, the Littorio's bows essentially combine some of the worst features of a number of different battleships. So you might see from this profile that, yes, she has a raked bow, it's not a vertical stem, which is, that's one improvement over some ships I could mention from the 1930s. But it's not particularly heavily flared. It's not particularly heavily raked. So in that respect, it's somewhat like the Scharnhorst's. You'll notice that's before the Atlantic bow upgrade. You'll notice that the height of the bow compared to the height of the rest of the ship, its freeboard, isn't that much greater than, say, amidships. So somewhat akin to the King George V, there's not a huge height on the bow to keep it above water if there's really rough seas. And then finally, because it's very, very fine, a bit like the Iowa's, the relatively extensive part of the forward part of the bow is going to be very negatively buoyant and is going to plunge. And, the Iowa's are known to be quite wet in rough weather. And if you've ever been on an Iowa, they have quite an extreme shear forward. This is going to have the same kind of plunging issues, but without the shear, so it's going to be even worse. So, that would be a major issue. Obviously, it's done in the interest of speed and in the interest of mostly operating in calmer waters. But if I was going to revise the Littorio design in any way, I think the bow shape would probably be my first port of call. Put on a higher shear, more raked, more flared bow, and try and solve a lot of the problems that way. But in the Atlantic, that's going to make things very uncomfortable. The other issue is that the Littorios for the modern battleships of World War II have a very, very, very low metacentric height. The Bismarcks are the opposite, and they have a very high metacentric height. And essentially, what this means in the shorthand is that the lower the metacentric height, the more likely your ship is to roll, but also the slower and more gentler that roll is going to be. The higher the metacentric height, the less likely your ship is to roll, but when it does roll, it's going to want to flick back to upright very, very snappily, very quickly. Now, theoretically, a low metacentric height also means that if you have a lot of battle damage on one side, you're more likely to capsize and sink, but that's battle damage, not operating in rough sea conditions. And weirdly, both ends of extremes when it comes to metacentric height can result in a stable gun platform. For something like the Littorio, you're almost always going to be rolling, you know, kind of the whole like Catalina roll on wet grass kind of thing. But it's going to be most of the time a fairly gentle, slow, predictable motion, which your fire control systems and stabilization can most likely take account of. But you're never going to be free of it. Whereas at the upper end, you're going to be fine, you're going to be fine, you're going to be fine until you hit really rough water. And then you very definitely are not fine. And you may well be snapping around so much that your fire control systems really can't cope with predicting and compensating for all of that, which is why most battleships tend to aim for something somewhere in the middle, because they want perhaps a higher reserve of stability and to stay level in calmer conditions, more so than the Littorios, but they also don't want to be snapping left, right and centre, giving everybody whiplash. So yeah, in the Atlantic or the Pacific, I suspect the Littorios, without modifications, apart from the range issues, would be burying their bows a lot and be sort of waddling a little bit all over the place as they roll heavily. But at least some of those issues could be compensated for with a short refit and modernization. Fitch's Fifth Fleet Fish Fleecer, Fiercely Fishing for Fleeting Fitch Fish for Four Fish Fritter Flavor Favors asks, since recent studies have concluded that the CSS Hunley was lost due to proximity to her own torpedo charge, what do you believe was to blame for this? Was it poor mechanical design, bad tactics, crew error, or just bad luck? And out of curiosity, how long would you have to make Hunley spar to make her survivable? I think ultimately it would have just been down to an imperfect, and understandably so imperfect, understanding of exactly how shockwaves propagate through water, and obviously the scaling effect that having bigger and bigger charges will have. So, on the day, probably just bad luck. However, there are potential solutions that could have been implemented in the design beforehand, and they wouldn't have been new solutions either. I don't think, really, the solution is just making the spar long enough to survive, because, honestly, you know, while some parts of Hunley's design were relatively advanced for their time period, she ultimately was put together at a bit of a rush on a bit of a budget. And that is not the kind of submarine, especially given that, you know, she'd already killed two of her crews, not the kind of thing I want anywhere near an underwater explosion, you know, regardless of whether I'm 20 feet, 30 feet, 50 feet or 100 feet away. I want to be many hundreds of feet away to the point that the effect is negligible. And as a result, if I was trying to improve her survivability, I wouldn't make her spar torpedo longer. I would just equip the spar charge with a timer. And this wasn't exactly a new idea either. Even the Turtle back in the American War of Independence had a basic clockwork timer attached to its charge. Because, well, if you look at the proximity of that thing, there's no way you would ever survive setting off the charge if you just used a poke here to make explode type detonator, which it appears that Hunley was using. And there's a few variations you could have used on that. Either a time, literally just a timer that's perhaps initiated either by impact or initiated by the crew as they pull away. Or if you wanted to be, you know, really, really basic, then just have the detonator attached to a line, or if you want to be slightly more advanced for the time period, perhaps a spool of wire, which is then connected to the sub. And then you draw back. And as you draw further and further back, obviously, eventually that line goes taut and initiates the detonator. And then the charge goes off once you've had a chance to back away. And I think that would have been the safest way to ensure the Hunley's survival. Eric Van Duting asks, did Japanese Navy doctrine in World War II call for intentionally aiming the guns short by a small amount to purposefully score underwater hits with their diving shells, or was that regarded as more of a nice thing if it happens, but still attempt to go for direct hits? Well, luckily for you, I actually happen to have a copy of the 1939 Japanese Navy Gunnery and Fire Control Manual. Now, it comes in multiple volumes. I only have one. And at the beginning, one of the ones that I'm missing, it talks about is the actual fire control equipment and gunnery equipment manual. So fortunately, the one that I have covers the mechanics of gunnery and the basics of gunnery doctrine, which is relevant for what we're talking about here. Now, according to it, the ideal aim point, all other things considered, is directly amidships, somewhat above the waterline. So that is a relatively conventional aim point for most navies. However, it does also immediately go on to specify that if the fire control directing officer decides that the aim point might shift, and it mentions shifting to the bow and the stern, which could be a minor correction because you think the shells are either falling ahead or behind the target, so that your speed estimation is off. Or if you think your gunnery is on target, you might be aiming to very quickly slow the ship down through flooding to the bow or disable its maneuvering by destroying the steering gear or something like that. But it also mentions, as essentially one of the three possible changes to the aim point, aiming directly at the waterline. Now, of course, as you know, when you fire a bunch of shells, it's not they are going to go exactly where you aim them. They're going to go, roughly speaking, in a circle or ovoid shape in and around that area. So if you're aiming directly at the waterline, theoretically, at least half of your shells will land short of that point, which indicates that the Japanese are thinking, as a start, as our baseline, that you're going to be shooting fairly conventionally, but one of the immediate changes that you might make, and which obviously these young gunnery officers are being told, well, the officer in charge might very well ask you to do, so be prepared for this, is to aim directly at the waterline, which indicates that they're not aiming for all of their shells to fall short, to score underwater hits, but they are aiming for a decent proportion of their shells to do so, and factoring that into their gunnery doctrine, because, of course, if you didn't have shells that you thought would dive through the water and cause some substantial underwater damage, you wouldn't want to immediately be consigning half of them to hit the sea. Lord Nelson asks, the capture of General Dumouriez and St. Jago on the 14th of April 1793 by British squadron resulted in one of the largest prize money allocations in naval history, with the money distributed numbering in the state budget ranges of the time. But why did the Spanish send out such a valuable cargo on a vessel that was easily overpowered by a privateer in the first place? Yeah, eventually the amount of money that was settled on was, as you said, quite a lot. Even the average sailor got somewhere between 5 and 7 years' wages out of that particular capture. I'm using a separate capture of Spanish treasure ships as the picture because no one seems to have actually painted this particular capture. And it is a rather interesting one, in as much as the French privateer, the General Dumouriez, captured the Spanish treasure ship. It's listed in English sources as the St. Jago, ST, and then J-A-G-O. I suspect that's actually the Santiago, just somebody's slightly misspelled it in the English language sources. But nonetheless, the French privateers captured the Spanish ship. Spain and England aren't at war at that point, but because she's captured, the Spanish ship is now flying a French colours, and then this British formation, which in and of itself is actually escorting their own convoy, comes across these two ships and captures them. And then it's like, oh, wow, they're full of treasure. We're quids in. It does lead to a bit of a diplomatic fallout because, of course, Spain, technically not at war with England at that point, is like, hey, can we have our stuff back? And initially, for political reasons, England or Britain says yes, but then on appeal, it's said, no, this was actually a fair prize. It's under French colours. Therefore, it counts as having taken it from the French. And basically, if the Spanish want compensation for the loss, they should go and persecute the French who took it off them in the first place. And that kind of doesn't help matters when it comes to the Spanish then getting involved in the Napoleonic Wars on the side of the French, ironically enough. Nonetheless, all that roundabout stuff aside, why on earth was the probably Santiago out on its own? Well, very early on, the Spanish had sent out individual treasure ships, the famous Manila galleons, for instance. They'd been targeted quite heavily, and so they'd moved over to a system of heavily escorted convoys, which made more sense. You know, load up a bunch of ships with valuables, guard them with a bunch of military ships, or in some cases, load up a bunch of military ships with valuables and sail them. However, there was one critical flaw in this system, which was becoming more and more evident as the 18th century wore on, and that was that you can't hide the movement of that many ships. It takes a long time to load them. They're very obvious. And because of their value, everybody's keeping an eye out for them, which then means that when they sail, people are going to know about it, and you get descended on by practically everybody. And, you know, a large fleet, because of the time it takes to organise, well, guess what? People like the French and the British will organise an even larger and or more powerful fleet to come and try and take as much of that valuable stuff off you as possible. And of course, if you do happen to lose a ship or multiple ships from such a fleet, the economic impact is absolutely catastrophic. And so, while some treasure convoys were still around, the Spanish did actually move over, at least in part, to sailing treasure ships solo. And this was for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it was far more flexible because obviously you didn't have to take the huge amount of time and effort to assemble a large convoy. So you could respond to need on a faster basis. Of course, you know, stocking up a ship full of treasures from South America could take time. But it also meant that you could obviously then sail whenever you wanted to. A single ship can hide in the deep ocean much better than a convoy. Now, of course, yes, a convoy and a single ship effectively operate in essentially the same space when it comes to detection on a larger scale. But this plays into another element of stealth, which is that if you are a small privateer force or a navy force or whatever, and you see several sails on the horizon, you know, a small convoy of ships, you're going to go, okay, they're sailing in convoy. That means they must have something valuable. We must go and investigate. Whereas if you see a relatively unobtrusive single ship sailing along, you might go after it. You might not. You know, it might be worth a case of, well, okay, that ship's a relatively swift sailer, and usually the Spanish would choose better sailing craft for these solo missions. It's going to take forever and a day to overhaul it. How valuable can one ship's cargo really be? Why don't I go and try and find something a little bit bigger or slower and easier to catch? And that obviously afforded a certain degree of safety to some treasure ships, combined with the fact that, as I said, because a single ship could slip out of port and sail pretty much whenever, it was much harder to anticipate where they were going to be and therefore organise forces to intercept them. Of course, it did happen, sometimes deliberately and sometimes accidentally. And if you had a particularly fast privateer like the General Dumouriez, and then you lost the treasure galleon, but it's all a calculated risk. HMAS Albatross asks, in your opinion, which of the scrap iron flotilla had the most interesting career? I had to think long and hard about this, but in the end, I came down on the side of HMAS Stuart, with Vendetta as a close second. A bunch of the others were lost in the early to mid part of the war, so you know, Waterhen, Vampire, etc., and therefore physically couldn't have additional careers beyond that point. And obviously, during their time in the Mediterranean, most of the Scrap Iron Flotilla saw most of the actions that the flotilla as a whole was involved in, obviously to slightly different degrees, but you know, pretty much all of them took part in Tobruk supply runs and so on and so forth. But when it comes down to it, the thing that tipped the balance for me between Stuart and Vendetta was a Matapan, because Stuart was there, and very little tops her interesting time charging straight through the Italian formation, firing left, right and centre, traditionally attributed with scoring at least one torpedo hit on an Italian cruiser and blowing various chunks off of various Italian ships, while simultaneously at one point, I believe, being mistaken for an Italian ship because they'd nicked an Italian machine gun at one point and were merrily firing on the Zara and Fiume. And the Italian ships thought that it was a case of friendly fire because they were firing with the Italian machine gun, which had Italian coloured tracer rounds in it. And so they thought she was an Italian destroyer. It was a very interesting night for Stuart. Camino John asks, during World War II, did anyone develop or deploy a truck-launched, land-launched torpedo system to sink enemy ships? I'm aware of the antiquated system that Norway used against the Germans. However, it seems there'd be plenty of cases where enemy-controlled coastlines could take pot shots at ships that strayed too close to shore. I recognise a torpedo launching system would require a minimum depth in terms of water, but you could back a flatbed truck up on a pier and lob the torpedoes without much warning. An entire torpedo company or regiment could be set up, which could include multiple launch points or vehicles, two or more range-finding stations, and a command and control truck which could launch a coordinated attack. Perhaps along the Italian coast or in the Guadalcanal campaign, such standalone batteries or an integrated system could potentially force enemy ships to be further away from shore and or take damage from shore launches. No, nobody seems to have come up with such a system, mostly because of the sheer logistics involved and also launch profiles, which you kind of mentioned. But to go into more detail, the average torpedo of the time, you look at 21-inch torpedo, weighs a little bit over a ton and a half. Now, that's not necessarily out of the transportation capabilities of trucks at the time. There are 2.5-ton trucks, 4-ton trucks, and that doesn't mean they weigh 2.5 or 4 tons. That's the load they're supposed to carry. So if you included some kind of road mobile cradle for them to sit in, then a 2.5-ton truck could probably haul around a single torpedo. A 4-ton truck might be able to haul around a pair. So moving the torpedoes themselves around in and of itself isn't so much of a problem. But you are then going to face the issue that, one, that's actually a relatively hefty truck that you're having, or that you're having to, you know, pull in to transport just one or two torpedoes, and a battery you're probably going to need several. So you're either going to need half a dozen 2.5-tonners or maybe 3-4-tonners in order to haul around just a single salvo of torpedoes. Then on top of that, you've got at least one truck to carry all the range-finding equipment, probably another truck to transport the communications equipment, and another truck which is going to be your command and control post at some higher level, maybe on a cliff or something like that. So assuming you're using the more common 2.5-tonners, you're looking at about 10 vehicles to move a single battery around that can launch one salvo of torpedoes. Because let's face it, you launch one torpedo, probably going to miss, or could be relatively easily evaded. A 10-truck convoy plus trailers for the torpedoes, because remember, the torpedoes themselves are usually as long or longer than the trucks, so you're not going to fit them on the back on a flatbed. That's a fairly hefty commitment of equipment and manpower. And then on top of that, you've got the problem that because it's a fairly large commitment, it's going to occupy a lot of space, a lot of volume. It's going to be relatively easily spotted. So roving fighter bombers or indeed just shore bombardment could be a problem in taking it out. And then ultimately, when they get to the coastline, torpedoes are quite heavy and they need to get up to a certain speed in order for their control surfaces to work properly, so they don't just sink uncontrollably. And if you are using a torpedo launcher, then obviously that has compressed air or black powder charges or whatever else they happen to use for that particular torpedo to get it moving. You're not going to have that with a truck-based system unless you take single or twin torpedo launchers from, you know, old World War One ships and somehow put them on some kind of wheeled base, at which point the whole thing's gotten a whole lot heavier. So now you're probably using a 4-ton truck to just move a single torpedo around. And even then, the torpedo's still going to need some depth of water to work properly before it, you know, comes up to the appropriate depth and motors on off into the distance at whatever target you've fired at. And that leads you to, well, the problem of the most of the coastline just isn't really shaped for that. And where there is a very sharp drop off on the coast, which would allow you to fire torpedoes like that, you usually find someone's already beat you to it and put a fixed torpedo launching installation there, like the one at Oscarsborg Fortress. And then you've also got the issue of aiming the thing, because you've got to manually set things like the gyro angle or depth control and speed and everything. Now, yes, you can do this with hand tools or small bits of equipment that you could transport by truck in theory, but you're going to have to swarm the torpedo, make it all these things ready out in the open, where a ship, if it's within torpedo range, is probably going to spot you and start shooting at you well before you get the torpedo off. And then all of that relies on you, even if there's a sudden drop off, or maybe you're at the end of a pier or something, you've now got to manually aim the torpedo in such a manner that all the settings you just put into it work properly. And hand aiming something that with its trolley is going to probably weigh 2-2.5 tons and is partially submerged, or if it's a, you know, recycled torpedo launcher, probably weighs in the order of 3-4 tons and is partly submerged or sitting on a pier or something, I don't think you're going to be hand aiming that with enough precision to launch it. Whereas obviously on ships and subs, there's either power control, or you point to the sub or the ship in the direction you want it to go, and there's a lot more fine control that's possible. Really, it's only with the advent of stuff like homing torpedoes that can self-course correct that it would become somewhat viable, mostly because you can then get rid of most of the ancillary equipment and you don't have to necessarily worry about firing large salvos either. But at that point, you're still faced with the issue of 99% of the coastline just isn't going to be suitable for launching the blasted thing. It's just much cheaper, easier, and more effective to stick a couple of torpedoes on a fast motorboat and send that out to launch things out at sea. Rob Smith asks, what was the role or fate of Monaco during World War One and World War Two? And for those of you wondering where on earth Monaco is, you can see it's here just to the little left of centre. So it's a tiny, tiny, tiny little principality just on the French side of the French-Italian border in the Mediterranean. In World War One, Monaco was ostensibly neutral, but quite heavily favoured the Allies, and managed to basically leverage that status throughout the war, and as a result remained pretty much untouched by the whole thing. The French took more of an influence in Monaco after the war, apart from anything, Monaco's hereditary ruling family is slightly German-descended, which they were not so happy about. But in World War II, with obviously a lot more overarching French control, Monaco loosely fell into the orbit of the Vichy French government, and so was again ostensibly neutral during the first part of World War II. But at the end of 1942, as the Vichy government basically was erased by the Germans going, oh yeah, that whole taking over France bit, I guess we're going to complete that now, because the Vichy French aren't dancing exactly to our tune the way they had been up until that point, then the Italians decided, okay, well, time for some small territorial acquisitions. And of all people, you know, the Italian army took over Monaco. So from the end of 1942 through to the Italians bowing out of the war toward the end of 1943, Monaco was no longer neutral because it was occupied by the Italians. And when the Italians bowed out of the war, obviously a lot of northern Italy, including Italian holdings such as Monaco, were then taken over by the Germans. And the Germans remained in control of Monaco until almost the end of the war, when they were then kicked out by a combination of Allied forces and the Marine Nationale, which showed up to shoot at a few things. And that was pretty much that. The ruling Prince of Monaco at that point had some significant German sympathies. The rest of the population, let's just say, weren't so keen on that. So he didn't really stay in charge of Monaco for all that much longer, and mostly spent the remaining period of his reign away from the place he was ostensibly in charge of, then dying and passing on his title in 1949. Ferrata Victrix asks, my father, who is an ex-submariner, told me a joke that was apparently popular among the crews he served with. Submarines are probably safer than aircraft because there are more planes in the sea than there are submarines in the sky. They found it especially funny when they told this to RAF personnel. What would be your pick for the best inter-service rivalry, joke, prank, or jape ever executed by the Royal Navy? I don't know if it's necessarily the best one in the entire recorded history of Royal Navy rivalry with the Army and then later the Air Force, but it certainly made me laugh quite a bit when I read it. So this is from a letter which came into my possession a few years ago, which is part of a collection from a sailor who served in the immediate pre-World War II and then World War II era Royal Navy. And from its position within his diary and other documents, I think this happened just before World War II, possibly during the time of the neutrality patrols for the Spanish Civil War. But in any case, this is at Gibraltar, hence the picture. And what happened is he was on board a battleship and it came in, you know, moored up on the mole, all normal, you know, shore leave, etc., etc. And then when they plan to head out, the ship's being manoeuvred away and out into the sort of the middle of the harbour so that it can get underway and head out. And as the ship's bow is coming around and essentially pointing at land, somebody on the bridge clearly noticed a small collection of either the garrison or, according to him, he says, some army lot. So possibly some troops in transit or whatever. But it's a nice, calm Sunday, Saturday morning, and they're all lined up for a parade, and everybody's, you know, facing it towards the rock. Officers are reviewing them, etc., etc. The calm, well, relatively calm work of manoeuvring the battleship around is underway. And then just as the bow is pointing straight at these poor, unfortunate soldiers, at about what he describes as about two ships' lengths, someone on the bridge just lets off the horn as hard and as loud as humanly possible, at which point everybody, that army unit who's facing away, not even aware that this thing was underway, suddenly jumps out of their skin at the extremely loud noise that's being projected at them, which apparently caused great merriment and amusement across the crew of the ship. And presumably an awful lot of shouting and red faces ashore, but they couldn't really do much because their audio antagonist was just in the process of leaving the harbour anyway. So I thought that was quite funny. You know, it's just a classic jump scare only pulled off with a 35,000-ton battleship. Coneled asks, what or who do you think are the five most worthy naval history individuals to not have a capital ship named after them? I thought initially this question was going to be quite difficult until you mentioned capital ships, and I thought, aha, well, there have been a number of very worthy individuals who have had ships named after them, but they haven't been capital ships. So as you might guess from the picture, I think Admiral Spruance certainly should have gotten a capital ship named after him. Now, yes, of course, there's the Spruance class of destroyers, but given that you have the Nimitz class carriers, personally, I think the follow-on should have been the Spruance class carriers. That's just me. Admiral Jellicoe should definitely have had a ship named after him, as should Admiral Cunningham. Captain Infernet of the Marine Nationale, I think, certainly should have had a capital ship named after him, because although obviously he was on the losing side of Trafalgar, as I've pointed out many times, he fought absolutely heroically. And it also, from the French, also means kind of like Inferno, which doubles up as a really good name for a capital ship. There was a cruiser named after him, but really he deserved a battleship, I think. Now, I'd be tempted to name Admiral Togo, but the thing is the Japanese Navy doesn't do naming ships after people. So instead I'm going to fall back to one of my old standbys, Admiral Cochrane. Thomas Cochrane should have gotten a capital ship named after him. The best he's managed was an armoured cruiser at the beginning of the 20th century so far. Randy Topeka asks, modern diesel engines use pressurized lube oil systems to feed lubrication bearings, but it seems like this wasn't the case at all on the majority of reciprocating steam engines. Given the bottom end of the engine seems largely similar between the two, and we see some engines comparable in power to today's, how were these engines able to survive without a constant flow of pressurized oil like in today's engines? Well, you know, I'm so glad that you asked, because having done the John W. Brown steam course, I can tell you all about how these engines work. Now, force lubrication did become a thing in reciprocating engines towards the end of their use, but really kind of mostly after their use had passed in capital ships, with the exception of in the US Navy. But for the majority of compound, triple expansion, and even quadruple expansion engines, the lubrication system worked in one of two ways. Either you stuck an oil can into moving machinery and lubricated it, and yes, I've done that, and yes, it is mildly terrifying, because if you get it wrong, then, well, at best, if you get it wrong, you're going to end up with a crushed oil can and oil dipper, which is going to make people very angry. And at worst, it's going to be your limbs, which are going to end up chewed up by the machinery. And the other option, which is in use in some parts of the engine system, is this thing. This is a little brass rectangular box. And when you look carefully around these machines, you'll see lots of these scattered around all over the place. And when you lift it up like this, you can see what looks like a whole bunch of worms swimming in oil. But they are not, in fact, worms. Nor are they an advanced form of life. They are, in fact, a form of worsted wool, which has then been threaded through, as you can see, with some wire. And what you do is as you can see, it's all dipped in the oil, and then you would pick one of these up, feed it through one of these little pipes, and then dip the head end back into the oil, and then via capillary action, that oil will soak up through and then down and drip at a given rate. And you can control how much oil and how often is dripped by varying the amount of the wool string that you are feeding down into the pipework. And then that drips down and drips onto the various parts of the machinery that need lubrication. So this one, along with several others, is found at the very top of the vertical triple expansion engine block on the John W. Brown. But you can see here down near the bottom of the same engine, just there on the kind of the bottom, just to the right of center, you can see another of those little boxes and a couple of smaller similar units mounted on some of the connecting rods there. So it's essentially working by a combination of manual input and very cleverly managed gravity feed, which is one of the reasons why when these things are going full pelt, it's advisable to have some form of waterproof with you, because there'll be condensation and oil dripping down around you all over the place. 31 Knot Burke, Chief of Naval Operations, asks, during the Battle of Midway, the destroyer Arashi sent out an intelligence report accurately identifying the composition of the American task force after the destruction of Akagi, Kaga, and Soryu. I've seen speculation that this report contributed to Yamamoto's decision to remain in the fight, so I was wondering what the chances would be of him ending the engagement in order to preserve Hiryu if this intelligence report never came in. So to put this in a little bit of context, Arashi manages to recover a pilot from Yorktown and through interrogation identifies that there are three American carriers present, Yorktown, Enterprise and Hornet. Now, what then happens is you have a confluence of mistaken Japanese intelligence and accurate intelligence from Arashi, because the Japanese initially don't know how many carriers the Americans have out there. But because of the fast work by Yorktown's damage control crews, when they hit Yorktown a second time, they think she's a different carrier because they know they hit Yorktown with bombs the first time. But when they come back, Yorktown's been patched up enough that the pilots don't think she's the same carrier because they're like, well, we didn't see any damage to the flight decks. And so they think that they've hit two different American carriers and they think they've left both in a sinking condition. And of course, actually, it's later on a submarine which torpedoes Yorktown to finish her off. But nonetheless, the Japanese are therefore convinced that they've at least badly damaged, if not sunk, two American carriers. And then Arashi turns up and says, hey, I've got this prisoner of war. And we've learned that there are only three American carriers total. And so, obviously, at that point, you can think, well, okay, we're down three carriers. We've only got Hiryu. But if they're only down to one carrier, maybe we can make something of this. Whereas, without that report, one of, I believe it was Chikuma's float planes, had radioed back and said, well, we've spotted this burning carrier, which the Japanese, again, think is the second one they've hit. In fact, it's still just Yorktown. But through a combination of both spotting Enterprise and Hornet and misidentifying a couple of other ships, it's reported there are four other carriers nearby. So without Arashi's report, the Japanese may have looked at things and gone, hang on, we've sunk two. There's another four out there somehow. So that's six carriers in total. And if they've got four left and we've only got one, maybe it would be time to drop back. So that potentially could be a decision. However, you've also got to bear in mind that when you're talking about carrier warfare, all these things are somewhat relative because while Arashi may make that report and Yamamoto or not make the report, and Yamamoto may or may not make a decision based on what he has to hand in terms of information, airstrikes take several hours to actually reach their targets. So almost regardless of what Yamamoto may or may not decide to do, chances are Hiryu is probably doomed anyway because there's a pretty good chance that the airstrike is already on its way. Reichsbeer Minister asks, Sal from What's Going On With Shipping said in his Unknown Facts About Pearl Harbor video that the US weren't aware the Japanese could refuel at sea. Why was that? Was it a case, once again, of they're Japanese, they would never know how to do X compared to our glorious, superior Western overlords? In this particular case, it's actually a fairly forgivable error on the US Navy's part, because the Japanese had practiced refueling at sea before, during the interwar period. However, it was somewhat sporadic, and they'd largely gone for the one forward and one aft setup, the same kind of situation that the British used for a good chunk of World War II, which was harder to maintain and of course meant you could only refuel one ship at a time. So while the Japanese were known to have had a fairly extensive interest in refueling at sea, as in they'd been practicing it for quite a while, it hadn't been practiced that much compared to the US Navy. And they were known to be using a method that the US Navy knew at this point was not the best. And therefore, they'd concluded that, well, based on that, they can't possibly have any significant implications for their fleet in terms of refueling at sea, the way that the US Navy would perhaps want to do. However, right towards almost the very end of the period of peace in the Pacific, when the Japanese are really ramping up preparations for the Pearl Harbor attacks, the Japanese Navy basically goes on a crash course of practical at-sea refueling. So obviously at this point, the Japanese are being incredibly secretive about what they're doing. They have been for some time at this stage. And there is a fair old leap in their at-fuel at sea refueling capabilities, which obviously then gets used during the Pearl Harbor attack in order to keep the fleet at sea. But to be perfectly honest, given that we're talking about, you know, a handful of months before the actual attack is launched, it's fairly forgivable for US intelligence to miss that, because they're not going to have anyone out there observing these exercises. And the Japanese seem to have been able to keep a fairly tight lid on the nature of these exercises as well, or at least the particulars of what exactly it was they were practicing. Peter Guy asks, I'm curious as to how they calculated the velocity and rotational speed of shells fired from modern battleship guns, say Dreadnought onwards. I've seen such figures expressed as X thousand feet per second of muzzle velocity and Y thousands of rotations per unit time after exiting the barrel. How were such figures calculated in the absence of incredibly high-speed video cameras? I'm guessing based on the weight of the shell, the amount of powder charge, and the particular rifling of the gun at hand. Well, high-speed photography does actually start to come into its own in the early 20th century. The first high-speed photography units are developed in the late 1800s. So by the early 1900s, you could theoretically stick a high-speed camera a couple of hundred feet away from a battleship gun, fire it, and then work out from the pictures what's kind of spacing the shells in those pictures are at, and therefore how fast they're going. But more practically, the way that it would be done, obviously, once you know the muzzle velocity, or very close to the muzzle velocity, you can work out the speed of rotation, because you know what the step in the rifling is, whether it's 1 in 20, 1 in 25, or 1 in 30, and then you can work out, well, you know, if a thing is passing along a rifled section of gun of X length at Y speed, it's going to therefore be rotating at, you know, Z RPM. But to do that, obviously you need to know the velocity, and to work out the velocity, one of the easiest and simplest ways they used to work all that out was actually one that went back a fair old distance, which sounds ridiculously simple when you actually stop to think about it. And that was, get an inert shell of the correct mass, because you'll see why you don't want the explosive bit in a minute. And then you aim your gun and you fire your gun, except instead of firing your gun well down range, you fire it at point blank range into a target. But the target is an impact face, so the shell basically slams into it, transferring its kinetic energy to the impact face. And that is then connected on a pivot to a weight, and that is then connected to a gradiated arc, which obviously you can then measure the distance and angle. So the idea being that you shoot your target, theoretically the vast majority of the kinetic energy from the impact is transmitted into the arm. The arm then swings, raising the weight, or moving it in some manner, however you want to do it. And since you know the exact dimensions of the arm, you obviously can see where the impact position was. You can work out from the law of moments and from the distance that that arm swung up to its maximum exactly how much energy has been transferred, because you know, well, you need this much energy to lift this weight of the arm this far. It's done that, therefore this much energy has been transferred. Once you have that kinetic energy value, now of course there will be some losses to heat and sound and so forth, but you know, for a decent approximation thereof, it's valid. And as I say, you know now the kinetic energy, you know the mass of the round, because you weighed it before you fired it, and so rearranging Ke equals half mv squared, you can then work that out to show you v squared, which you can then do the square root of, and that gives you v, the velocity, and then once you have that velocity, you can, as I said, transfer that into working out the rotation of the shell. Explicitly Implicit asks, when looking at and comparing internal combustion engines of the World War II era, one commonality virtually all of them share is the four-stroke operating cycle. I was wondering, why were two-stroke engines so underrepresented in many fields? For example, high-performance aero engines and torpedo engines. Now, I'm not an internal combustion engine specialist, but from what I've picked up listening to particularly aviation historians talking about this, I think, if I recall correctly, that two-stroke engines have a higher power-to-weight ratio and are simpler, well, because there's less parts to them. However, they are less durable, therefore more likely to break down and need maintenance in the first place. They have a fairly narrow power band, whereas four-stroke engines can operate across a wider range of RPMs and put out a decent amount of power. And also the fuel efficiency of a two-stroke engine is significantly behind that of a four-stroke engine. So if you're trying to maximize range, which is important obviously for torpedoes and ships, and if you don't want to constantly having to be fixing the blaster things because they're broken down, you're much better off with a four-stroke than a two-stroke. But as I said, if you happen to know a lot about internal combustion engines, and particularly the differences between two-strokes and four-strokes, then please elaborate further in the comments below. But that's what I recall from, as I said, talking mostly to aviation historians about why there weren't more two-stroke engines in aircraft versus four-stroke. Paul from Chicago asks, I was reading an article about Collingwood in the most recent Trafalgar Chronicle from the Journal of the 1805 Club. All the listeners should check it out. Yes, I highly recommend you do. They also do a really good Trafalgar night dinner. On page 52, there was a reference to some British captains not doing their utmost at Trafalgar. It seems almost acrimonious. I'd not heard about this before. What exactly happened? Unfortunately, in some ways, this was Nelson's pre-battle decisions coming back to bite the fleet after the fact, at least from my estimation. So essentially what Nelson had done is when forming up his columns, he had put the best sailing ships near the front, which made sense to a certain degree, because while that did mean that his particular line ended up with three three-deckers all one after the other, it also meant that Collingwood's line obviously had Royal Sovereign at its head, but then he was immediately followed by a bunch of third rates. There were several other three-deckers in the fleet, but when you look at the two lines, they're spaced out at irregular intervals and one or two are actually quite near the back. And as most of you will know, the Battle of Trafalgar was fought in fairly light airs and no one was making any great progress at any great speed. And this meant that once you came under fire from the Franco-Spanish fleet, you could be under fire from them for quite some time before your ship managed to breach the line and, you know, actually get into the action. And similarly, this meant that ships much further back in the line had even longer to sail before they could get into the action. Plus, the entire action was kind of drifting gradually eastwards. And because the best sailors were at the front of the line and some of the worst sailors were near the back, HMS Prince, for example, a very powerful ship, but known to sail pretty much like haystacks don't, ended up taking forever and a day to get there. And as far as I know, a lot of the immediately post-battle acrimony where people are like, well, you know, we spent, you know, 45 minutes under enemy fire before we could get a shot off, and then we spent several hours shooting up the French and the Spanish and being shot, and you showed up 15 minutes before it was all over kind of stuff. As far as I can tell, I don't think there was a huge amount of British sailors and captains trying to avoid getting involved in action, but there was an awful lot of the worse sailing vessels not really being able to actually do all that much in terms of getting there, which, of course, if you're involved in the prolonged action and you look on halfway to the horizon, you're like, oh yeah, there's one of our ships. And then 2 hours and a lot of cannon fire later, you're looking, oh, they're still coming. They're almost here. You can kind of see how some captains who got involved a bit earlier on be like, oh, were you sure you were doing everything you possibly could do to get involved? Kirsten Darkin asks, in the age of sail, what was the worst weather a decisive engagement was fought in, and how did the weather influence the conduct and outcome of the battle? There's quite a few different candidates. I mean, the fight between Indefatigable and Amazon versus Droit de l'Homme would be a good one. But one of the ones which I always come back to, and I think long-term viewers will not be surprised by this, is the Battle of Quiberon Bay, which I don't think has ever really been given the full treatment it deserves in terms of dramatic paintings and so forth. Because not only was the battle fought at all because the French thought there is no way the British fleet is going to be mad enough to follow us in rocks and shoals they don't know in this kind of weather. Spoiler alert, Admiral Hawke was that mad. But then once the battle's actually engaged, the weather has a huge effect on what's going on, because obviously, even in calm weather, the way Hawke commands his ships running into Quiberon Bay would be considered the mark of a lunatic, let alone doing it in the middle of a massive storm. You know, I'm almost tempted to try and find somebody to commission a song, and I know the song, the title Riders of the Storm, has probably been used ad infinitum in various songs of vaguely differing quality, but it really does apply to the British fleet at that point. They're literally running with an oncoming storm, which demoralizes the French quite significantly before the battle starts. But between the onset of darkness and the weather closing in, most of the fleet has no idea what the rest of the fleet is doing on both sides, which at one point leads to Hawke's flagship chasing a good chunk, I think it's 13 other French ships. And the other French ships are like, ah, well, you know, here comes this big English flagship. Clearly no one would be mad enough to try and chase down 13 ships of the line with just one, despite the fact they've just seen Hawke lead his ships through what should have been a suicidal charge. Never mind. Therefore, the rest of the fleet must be following. Therefore, we need to retreat. So you get this sort of almost Benny Hill style situation where two-thirds of the French fleet is running from Hawke in his one ship. And you get all sorts of dramatic stuff. I mean, I've got a three-part video series on Admiral Hawke, which I want to actually release over the course of a fortnight. So it'd be two Wednesday videos and a Friday video. And one of those videos is almost entirely dedicated to Quiberon Bay. But you get all sorts of stuff like a French ship and a British ship trading blows at point-blank range, and then a massive wave comes in because they're broadside onto the storm at that point. And the British ship is just that little bit quicker off the mark. It's commanded by a captain who's just that little bit better, a sailor. And he manages to bring his ship around just in time to keep it afloat. And the French ship, just that fraction slower off the mark, gets swamped and basically does a Mary Rose. Just goes down pretty much instantly. And oncoming ships have to dodge around the mast sticking up out of the water. And Admiral Hawke's flagship, for example, inflicts basically a one-shot fatality on a French ship of the line. And the whole thing, it's more ridiculous action movie than ridiculous action movies are, because in most movies, at least the enemy ship would take more than one broadside to put down. In that particular case, this French ship basically is interposing itself, trying to stop Hawke getting at the French flagship, comes up on a massive wave. Hawke's flagship just delivers a point-blank full three-decker broadside into this poor French two-decker, rips it apart at the waterline, and the French two-decker goes down the slope of this massive wave that it was previously cresting, filling with water as it goes, and basically as it hits the trough, it just keels over on its side and disappears. It is quite literally, you know, it's a one-shot fatality without even hitting a magazine. And by the time the battle is over, it mostly is over because visibility and the weather have gotten so bad that everybody just kind of goes, you know what, at this point, the worst enemy is the sea. We're just dropping anchor here and, you know, calling time out on the battle until everything sorts itself out. And then the next day when dawn rises and you know, the weather starts to clear, a whole bunch of ships on the British fleet side are like, oh, you're over there. I didn't realize you're over there. And they can literally shout at each other. That's how close they are. They had no idea they were that close to each other at night because they just dropped anchor thinking, well, I'm in the middle of a swirling rainstorm. I don't know what's going on. And a few French ships are kind of like, guys, we're in the middle of the British fleet. We should probably skedaddle quite quickly. Physical removal enthusiast asks, in submarines, space and weight are even bigger concerns than they are on surface ships. So my question is, where did submarines of the time period the channel covers store fresh water? They would have small freshwater tanks. So if you look very carefully at this plan, you'll see that in this example, that at a T-class submarine, there's a really little freshwater tank underneath the bilge pump just below the crane for the torpedo hatch up front, and then there's a somewhat larger freshwater tank right aft, just below the steering gear. Now, obviously, that's not a huge amount of fresh water for the whole crew, but of course, what you would be using that for was very limited aboard a sub, essentially only for stuff you absolutely vitally needed fresh water for. Now, there is a little bit of a misnomer going around, which is, for some bizarre reason, extremely loudly trumpeted by some people on various websites, where they're like, ah, yes, well, you know, the Royal Navy didn't have any freshwater distillers on their ships, or their subs, more specifically. And the US did. Well, yes, it's a fact that the US did have distillers or evaporators, depending on what terminology you want to use at the time, on their fleet subs, which is understandable because obviously they had larger crews and they were designed for very long range operations. So naturally, you have to top up your limited storage of fresh water. But most other navies during World War II would have fresh water distillers or evaporators on their subs sooner rather than later. The exact capacity of these systems could vary quite considerably. German systems, for example, mostly through being of a smaller size, were known for producing a relatively small amount of fresh water each day compared to the capacity of, say, a Gato class. And whilst if you search this plan, you'll be hard-pressed to find an evaporator or distiller labelled on it because, yeah, pre-war, submarines like the T-class, which were not designed as long-range patrol submarines, they were designed as attack submarines. They would go out, find a target in a known area, fire off with a massive 10-torpedo forward spread, reload for any targets of opportunity, and then come back. So for them, having fresh water on board could be compensated with by just using those small freshwater tanks. On larger, more long-distance patrol subs and mine layers and stuff, you would find evaporators or distillers. And as the war progressed and it became clear that essentially using T-class subs as interceptors to race out and fire torpedoes and come back home again wasn't really going to be their actual use in World War II, the Royal Navy, shockingly, started to install distillers and evaporators aboard their subs. Again, not quite up to the same level of capacity as the American Gato class, or the Belows or the Tenches for that matter, but still enough to keep those freshwater tanks topped off. And ultimately, as well, any submariner who's had to serve on a diesel electric sub will tell you, even in Cold War era subs where the distillation systems are considerably more advanced than any sub in World War II, you're still not swimming in fresh water. Well, hopefully not, otherwise something's gone horribly wrong, but you're also not, you know, having fresh water in great supply. You do have to rather strictly ration it. Colin Olsen asks, what would have happened if Lützow had been in the lead going into Oslo Fjord instead of Blücher? Initially, probably very similar to what happened to Blücher, because, well, assuming that she's fully loaded with troops and explosives and all sorts of other inflammables, then the hit that Blücher takes that causes fires that then set off explosives that then punch a hole through and start to cripple her machinery, the same thing's going to happen to Lützow. In fact, it might happen worse to Lützow because Lützow's deck armor over that area is so fractionally thinner than Blücher's was. You've also got to remember that historically, Lützow had its forward armament disabled by a lucky shot, but you know, that's neither here nor there, really. And then when the torpedoes hit, arguably a Deutschland-class Panzerschiff has even worse torpedo protection than a Hipper-class heavy cruiser does. So, yeah, that's not going to end well. And both the Hippers and the Deutschlands presage Bismarck's wonderful German efficient design feature of having secondary battery magazines in the middle of the machinery spaces, because that's always a good idea for long-term survivability. And indeed, that is one of the things that pretty much does in for Blücher. Fire spreads to one of her secondary magazines, magazine explodes, there goes the rest of the power plant. And at that point, it's kind of just, well, how long have you got before she rolls over and sinks? Lützow's going to be in pretty much exactly the same position. You could make an argument that because she's got a very widespread diesel machinery plant, that she'll have some of her diesel still online, so she might retain some more power overall than Blücher does initially. But honestly, you know, once she takes those torpedo hits, fires will be spreading from above and from below. The magazines are still there. They're going to go off. it's going to cripple a good chunk of her machinery. And at that point, it doesn't really matter whether you've got one or two diesel motors still online. It just that all that's going to change is whether you sink further up the fjord or where Blücher historically sank. So, yeah, it's not going to help. Top tip, don't put large amounts of explosives in the middle of your machinery spaces. You know, the single largest open void spaces on the ship. Because if you start taking damage and fires to them, it's not going to end well for you. I mean, it's not going to end well for you generally if you have a secondary magazine fire, but it's going to end even less well for you if you put it in basically the exact position to be a giant unintentional scuttling charge. The Past Is Another Country asks, what did the naval side of 1930s British rearmament look like? In your answer to my previous question, you mentioned that Britain was desperate for destroyers and escorts. Surely they had to realise they didn't have sufficient escort numbers, or was it simply a classic case of too many needs and not enough resources? Yeah, it was mostly too many needs, not enough resources, because there were a lot of very big ticket items that the rearmament funds needed to be put into. Firstly, they had to address some of the shortfalls in maintenance and refits that had been allowed to build up by the Royal Navy trying to maintain the fleet numbers, not necessarily that it needed, because it didn't have the numbers it needed, but trying to maintain the numbers close to what it needed in the face of very strict budgetary controls in the first half of the 1930s. So while they were catching up on that, they also then had to factor in the additional costs of maintaining and operating more ships, because the original plan had been to decommission the R-class on a one-for-one basis as the King George V came online, and then decommission the Queen Elizabeth on a one-for-one basis as the Lion class came online. And then that all got changed to, actually, we're going to keep the R class around until the Lion class come into service. So now they're having to operate the R class for longer. So all that has to be factored in. And obviously, because that also kicks the QEs further down the road, that meant you now had to factor in for the modernization of some of the Queen Elizabeths, and obviously Renown, preparing for the modernizations of other ships, so all the big ticket ships, the expansion of the carrier building program. They had to invest in more armor and gun manufacturing. They came up with a plan for Vanguard. What else was there? Cruiser programs, although politically the government was still trying to persuade everyone not to build heavy cruisers. Yeah, that went well, didn't it? Trying to work out, should we go with these extreme quart into a pint pot Fiji-Crown Colony classes, which are technically second London Treaty compliant, or should we just go back up to building lots of Belfasts and or Edinburghs, I suppose, and so on and so forth. There was this whole line of new destroyers that were coming out because they sensed that the old, you know, 1,400 ton four-gun destroyer, which had been the bread and butter of Royal Navy interwar destroyer construction, was probably no longer really viable as a frontline ship. So that you'd had the Tribals, and then they were developing the other big twin mount destroyers, the J's, which were the smallest of them, and then the L's and the M's and so forth. There was a lot of talk about, do we build perhaps this hybrid ship that's half small cruiser, half large destroyer instead? Do we build a combination fleet like the French with large and small destroyers? So they're essentially trying to modernize, rework, and renew the entire fleet from the top down. And in amongst all of that, there's also, as well as, you know, obviously building large numbers of destroyers, there's also this need of, well, we also need ocean escorts for the convoys. But there's only so many shipyards and there is only so much money, because despite the fact that everyone's on a big rearmament spree, the Treasury is still desperately trying to stop everything because it's inconvenient for their pocketbooks. I mean, literally, what, 2-3 months before the war starts, the Treasury is trying to order the Royal Navy that, oh, well, if you must rearm in a way that isn't going to impinge on British trade in time of war. So basically, the Treasury has got it into its head that if the Royal Navy doesn't build substantial forces indicating it's going to try and run convoys, then somehow this will mean that everybody else has forgotten about the British merchant fleet and therefore won't attack them. Yeah, this is why people who have been hit on the head one too many times as a kid go into the Treasury. But there is also, to be fair, this sense that if we invest our rearmament money, and bearing in mind they expect the war to start in 42, not 39, but they're thinking if we invest our initial rearmament money in the long-term programs for the big ships, those will then be coming online in the early 40s, and we can then dump the early 40s rearmament funds into mass-producing vast numbers of quickly built escort ships, which is kind of what they're gearing up for when war actually breaks out. Because as Dr. Clark likes to point out quite a bit, things like the Flower Class corvettes, they are not emergency wartime orders. They do order more of them because of the outbreak of war, but the first several dozen Flower Class are ordered in summer 1939 before war breaks out. And for those of you who've been following along at the back, that means, of course, that the design of the Flower Class had to be put together earlier than summer 1939. And for somebody to have a design that was accepted and ready to go, that meant that everyone had to be thinking about what they were going to do as a cheap mass-produced escort earlier still. So this was a pre-war element of Royal Navy thinking, that they need to find a decent, or at least reasonable, quickly built deep ocean escort. But as it turns out, war comes earlier than they expect. So if war had come when they expected, the Royal Navy would have been swimming in deep ocean escorts. But because it starts that those few years earlier, it means that the small ships, which are the things that I said can be quickly built, are the things the Royal Navy is lacking in the most. F-19A Ghost Rider asks, regarding the Japanese use of carriers as decoys for the Battle of Leyte Gulf, I've wondered if the plan could have been better if they'd stuffed as many planes as they could onto Zuikaku, then taken the three light carriers, Zuiho, Chitose and Chiyoda, and basically turned them into flak traps by emplacing several anti-aircraft guns on their open flight decks. Would that idea have been feasible if someone in the Japanese Navy had thought of it? They'd already accepted the carriers would be sacrificed anyway, so why not lay an unexpected trap to cause even more trouble and attrition for US aircraft, since they expected them to come raining down on them anyway? Well, I think from the Japanese mindset, there are probably two things that mitigate against this. Firstly is that if you pile all your aircraft onto Zuikaku, if Zuikaku gets hit, you are very stuffed. And also, obviously, if you pile all your aircraft onto Zuikaku, you're relying on the ability to launch aircraft at whatever rate Zuikaku can launch aircraft at, whereas if your aircraft are distributed across lots of different carriers, then obviously A, you're not as vulnerable to losing any one of them early, but B, when the time comes, you can launch pretty much all of them very quickly, because each carrier only has to launch a few. Now, with that said, the kind of plan you describe, I think would be somewhat viable. I would only put two caveats on it. Firstly, you're not going to get anything particularly heavy in the form of an anti-aircraft gun on a ship's flight deck, and also you've got to find somewhere to supply it with ammunition from. But also, you've got to take into account that they are counting on these ships being spotted by the US and the US coming to engage them. If the US recon aircraft show up and they go, oh, look, right, there's the one carrier here, and then there's all these other carriers, but they seem to be covered in lots of light anti-aircraft guns, assuming the Japanese can spare that many 25 millimeters. I mean, they did build a lot, but still. Then the US might smell a trap and decline the engagement. But in theory, I think something could potentially have been pulled off, because what you would do in that case would be to have a whole bunch of light and possibly light medium anti-aircraft guns, but wheeled ones, so land-based versions, have them stored in the hangars alongside whatever small remnants of aircraft you have. You let yourself be spotted. You are a perfectly normal set of smaller carriers alongside Zuikaku. And then when the time comes, your aircraft go off and get launched. And then you use your aircraft lifts to bring up your little wheeled 25mm and maybe 3-inch AA guns with a bunch of pre-prepared ammo. And you then wheel them out across the flight deck and set them up in pre-arranged positions, giving you a massive additional boost to your anti-aircraft firepower, at least at short range, and wait for the enemy to come to you. And in theory, then, instead of obviously your magazines being full of ammunition for aircraft, your magazines would be partly full of anti-aircraft ammunition, which could then be brought up in large batches by your aircraft elevators and then run across to the guns by some very, very brave dash suicidal people. Of course, there would be limitations to this, like the fact that torpedo bombers would be very difficult to engage because you have the flight deck limiting your minimum elevation, and the fact there are other anti-aircraft emplacements around. You don't want to be accidentally shooting your own people. So, you know, the 25mm might struggle a bit, but I suppose you could use them against dive bombers and fighters and so forth. And maybe if you position them around the edge of the flight deck, you'll get some better fire arcs going as well. So it could be done, but given that the Japanese fully expected to lose those ships, I think it would also be a question of, would the Japanese be prepared to put that many anti-aircraft guns and that many trained anti-aircraft gunners on ships they are expecting to lose? Ivan asks, I thoroughly enjoyed your videos on the development of ironclads in the Royal Navy. Are you planning on doing something similar for other navies after the Royal Navy? I'd be very interested in Marine Nationale ironclad development, for instance. Ideally, yes, I'd like to, once I've finished with the Royal Navy, which, well, hopefully early next year should be maybe a video or two, and then that'll wrap that up. However, there are two rather large issues which could make that rather interesting. Firstly, is that while there are, let's use the Marine Nationale as an example since you mentioned it, while there are a good number of decent sources in English which talk about the French pre-dreadnought program and then their various battleships, there are nowhere near as many good sources in English talking about the French ironclad program. Some of the sources which I have used for the Royal Navy sections thus far do actually occasionally mention various French designs as contrasts at various points, like Gloire and so forth. But obviously they're not going into detail about every single one and why it was designed and what the strengths and weaknesses were, etc., etc. Now, that's not to say it's impossible. There are articles on specific French ironclad designs which can be pieced together, and there obviously are sources that can be translated, but it would be a lot of additional work compared to the British ones for research purposes, unless, of course, I can track down something I've not heard about before, something like, you know, the French ironclad fleet in English. If anyone knows if there's a really good book on the French ironclad fleet specifically in English, let me know. Or, to be perfectly honest at this point, if you happen to speak French or are French and know of a French book which goes into quite a lot of detail about the ironclad fleet from Gloire all the way up to Hoche, please let me know, because I'll go through the process of getting it translated, because that would be a lot easier than having to piece together 14 billion different separate articles and verifying each one. And then as you develop further out from that into other ironclad fleets, I think you'd end up with, I think for the Marine Nationale, certainly there could be several videos in it, kind of like with the Royal Navy, but then you very rapidly start to drop off a cliff, and you'd end up with some nations that would just end up with, here is a video on their sum total ironclad development, and some nations which might even need to be grouped together with a bunch of other smaller nations, because at least in the style that I've done the Royal Navy videos, there may only be 15-20 minutes or potentially less to talk about their ironclad developments. The US Navy, I think there's probably two videos in there, because there's one video to talk about the American Civil War era ironclads and monitors, and then another video to talk about what they did between that and the rise of the Steel Navy, which isn't a huge amount, to be perfectly honest. And yes, I know there were a lot of different monitors, but once you've discussed the main themes of monitor design, quite a lot of the American Civil War stuff can be said of, like, right, they'd done all this, we've explained why they did this, and here's a subtle variation on that, but that doesn't need the full treatment again, and so on and so forth. So yeah, two, maybe three videos on the American Navy, probably I'd say three or four on the Marine Nationale, then it starts to get a bit more difficult, especially because a huge number of ironclads that various nations had at that point were built by Britain or France and kind of are extensions of the British and French building programs, which would be quite amusing in some ways. Cody774 asks, when the Lexington-class carriers were armed with an 8-inch battery, what were the considerations due to the effects of cross-deck firing? Were the blast effects from these guns able to damage the flight deck? And if so, what restrictions were in place, like only firing at certain elevations or angles across the deck? Well, when you see photos like this one or video footage, which does indeed exist, of the Lexingtons firing their guns, it's almost entirely with them firing their guns over the side rather than cross deck, because, of course, all of this is done in peacetime. There are a handful of pictures and videos of them firing cross deck, but the ones that I've been relatively easily able to come across tend to have them firing guns at quite a high elevation. So obviously that's going to minimize the blast effects on the flight deck itself. And of course, there's the question of what is happening to your flight deck, because if the flight deck is empty, that's one thing. If the flight deck has a bunch of aircraft on it, especially interwar aircraft, yeah, you absolutely do not want to be firing guns across those, because that's a very easy way to wreck all your aircraft. But I get the impression, looking at the various orders and so forth for the Lexingtons, that the approach to cross-deck firing was very similar to the approach of full salvo firing or over-the-shoulder firing on the Nelson class, in that ideally in peacetime one should avoid it because it is going to rip up your own deck somewhat, especially if you're firing at relatively shallow angles. But in wartime, if you have to, I mean, let's examine the circumstances. In wartime, if the Lexingtons have to engage a surface target with their 8-inch guns, A, something has already gone quite badly wrong. B, if you're having to engage across the flight deck, you then have to ask, okay, well, what is preventing you from just turning the ship and engaging them, not over the flight deck? And if the answer is there's an awful lot of enemy ships, thus, if you go that way, it, you know, and your escorts presumably aren't able to deal with the situation, then something has gone very badly wrong, at which point the fact that you're going to chew up your flight deck probably doesn't matter all that much. And then thirdly, if you are firing at a low elevation across your flight deck, that means that not only have you been outflanked by an enemy force that you can't turn away from to bring your unengaged side to bear, but if you're firing at very low elevation, they're very close to you, which means they're probably pouring fire into you at that very moment, at which point you genuinely do not care at all what's going to happen to your flight deck when you fire those guns. Because, yeah, stuffing your own flight deck up with some blast of 8-inch gunfire in exchange for driving off or even potentially damaging or sinking an enemy ship that is currently pouring shellfire into you more generally is infinitely more preferable to, oh no, we can't afford to damage our own precious flight deck, and then being blown apart by said enemy ship. Lord Drukan asks, you mentioned in Guide 471 that during the construction of Warrior and Black Prince, there was still some debate as to whether or not the Age of Wooden Ships had ended at that point. Did the use of ironclads during the American Civil War convince the doubters that the Age of the Wooden Ship was over, or did that just come as new technological innovations were developed, or was it a combination of both? You'd think incidents like Merrimack taking down the Cumberland, like you see here, would kind of put paid to the idea of wooden warships fighting ironclads. But actually, the American Civil War was cited by both sides of the argument as to whether or not the era of the wooden warship was over. Because, yes, you could point to things like CSS Virginia or Merrimack, depending on what you want to call her, taking out Cumberland, and the fact that, obviously, then the Union brought in its own ironclad to try and deal with the Virginia. But others pointed out that even with, you know, full wartime industry going on both sides, neither side, and especially the Union side, which had the bigger industry, had been able to fully supplant or replace their fleet with ironclads. And what ironclads they had built, with the exception of New Ironsides, were mostly fairly small coastal craft, i.e. the monitors, not able to really fight out at sea. And therefore, there were arguments saying, well, you know, clearly, even in wartime, production is limited, so you can't build that many of them, so you need to be in multiple places at once. Therefore, there are plenty of other places where a wooden ship could be. commerce rating especially, or commerce protection, depending on which side of that particular coin you were on, then other people say, well, yeah, okay, great. So we, as in Britain, have built a few big ocean-going ironclads, but the Americans couldn't even build one, and the one that came close, the United States, set itself on fire. So therefore, at sea, you know, i.e. in the open ocean, yes, these small ironclads, the monitors, might have considerable firepower per shot, but they only have very few guns and they can't fire very quickly. So a big maneuverable steam auxiliary ship of the line should still be able to close them down and overwhelm them with lots and lots of rapid fire, relatively speaking. That was a genuinely discussed potential tactic. And then, of course, there were also arguments about, well, yes, the armor that can be put afloat these days can resist most current guns, but towards the middle of the 1860s, bigger guns were in development, which could pierce 4-4.5-inch armor. Therefore, if the armor can be defeated, then surely a wooden ship of the line with more heavy guns, because they're not having to put the weight into armor, can punch through the armor of a armored vessel, which obviously is carrying fewer guns because it's putting some of its displacement into that armor, and therefore they'll win, because essentially at that point both sides are equally vulnerable, except the one that lacks pretty much all armor is able to carry more firepower. And arguments like this circulated back and forth and around and around. And as I said before, you know, the expense, can we build enough to actually cover all our commitments and so on and so forth. But as new technology continued to develop and more and more armored ships came around and armor itself got thicker and thicker, and it was clear that guns weren't going to very easily win the gun armor race, people started to realize, oh, actually, we can build a fair number of ironclad ships, and armor is still useful as a long-term thing rather than a flash-in-the-pan gimmick, and we need to take that on board. Now, that's not to say there weren't a lot of useful lessons learned about armored ship warfare from the American Civil War, but for obvious reasons, an awful lot of that circulated around the use of armored vessels in close contact with shore defenses and on rivers and so forth. And finally, Fall to Earth asks, in Shattered Sword, it is mentioned that Yamamoto's decision to go for deception and splitting his forces to tempt the Americans into combat was driven by a fundamental misunderstanding of his enemy. Do you agree with this analysis, and could you explain your basis for this position? The planning chapter mentions this as an explanation for Yamamoto's decision to dilute his forces, but I'm curious what modern historical understanding of Yamamoto's analysis that the Americans needed to be baited to leave Pearl Harbor is. So I should probably go back and reread that chapter again, but if my memory is serving me correctly, my general understanding of the position is essentially that Yamamoto was looking at it from a reasonably logical perspective of, yes, the operation is designed to take Midway. However, ideally, we also want to lure out and destroy what's left of American carrier strength, you know, sooner rather than later, before they can rebuild and repair and so on and so forth. And bearing in mind that the whole thing is predicated on the fact that the Japanese think that they've inflicted considerably more losses on the Americans at Coral Sea than they historically actually have. So they're thinking that the US is not able to really deploy that much in terms of carrier strength. And so, again, as I say, Yamamoto's looking at it from a logical position of, if I was in the enemy camp and massive overwhelming enemy forces were coming at Midway, and I only have a limited number of forces left to me, and it's very clear that I'm going to lose if I take my small fleet, presumably at that point, according to Japanese intel, maybe two carriers, up against six or more, then I won't do that. I would rather, tie down Japanese forces attacking Midway. Yes, I might lose Midway, but that's better than losing Midway and my fleet, and then, you know, because I've lost my fleet, we lose Midway anyway. Better to hold on as much as possible and hope to get more ships coming in. Because, of course, by the time of Midway, the Japanese are aware that the Americans are building Hornet. They're aware that Wasp, for the minute, exists. Lexington, obviously, they think has been sunk, but they know Saratoga's around somewhere. They know that she's been damaged, but might come back at any point. Ranger is still technically a factor. So potentially the Americans can pull together, just from their existing, let alone any new builds or conversions, a decentish carrier force if you give them time. So don't scare them too much. Make a force that looks, you know, it has the strength, according to Japanese intel, to win, but also looks like it might be a force that maybe the existing American forces can blunt. Again, the existing American forces, the Japanese think that the Americans have. And therefore, obviously, you know, if you don't look too threatening, the enemy might attack you, then you hit them, that's just what you want, then you kill them, fantastic, great, now you have won. Of course, there is a fundamental misunderstanding on several levels. Firstly, of course, the Americans have more carriers available to them in the immediate term than the Japanese think they do, because of aforementioned misunderstanding of who exactly had lost what at Coral Sea. And secondly, there's also the fact that for the most part, not all the time, because occasionally the Americans would be a little bit more hesitant, but for the most part, the US Navy was far more aggressive than the Japanese thought that they would be. Because again, the Japanese were thinking about this in not quite pure Vulcan logic terms, but certainly in more terms of, this is a disadvantageous position, therefore we shouldn't fight it, therefore we, you know, we'll do something else. Whereas the American position generally was, if we have the advantage, we fight. If neither side has the advantage, we fight. And if we have a slight disadvantage, we fight anyway. And only if we have a really, really, really big disadvantage will we think about potentially not fighting, but we probably will want to anyway, depending on who's in charge. So factor in that obviously the Japanese Navy has other objectives than Midway, and suddenly the Japanese show up with a force that, at least carrier-wise, thanks to that combination of faulty intel and not being laser-focused on assuming the worst situation in terms of what the enemy opposition could be, the Japanese show up with a fleet where the Americans are going to go, you know what, I think we can have a chance here. And it turns out they do. At least that's my understanding of the general position from memory. And that wraps up this particular Patreon dry dock. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. And, well, it's the end of 2025. Onwards into 2026. And hopefully it will be a decent year for the channel going forward. Who knows? The AI slop channels might even die horribly in a fire. We can but hope. Anyway, see you again in a hopefully wonderfully toasty new year.